You're listening to a Comics XF podcast.
Hi, listeners. Matt and Will here. Before we get into this week's episode, we wanted to put a little tag here at the beginning. I think we make it pretty clear, and actually I think Will mentions it at the beginning of this episode, but we record these episodes about 3 weeks to a month in advance of when you get them. So occasionally we talk about things that are no longer relevant, and sometimes things that wind up weirdly relevant. This week's opening has discussions about problematic creators and various societal issues. So to start with, a content warning for transphobia, homophobia, and suicide. The issue of problematic creators is something that we as a fan community are constantly wrestling with. It's why I try to put on problematic creator watches, and myself am regularly wrestling with the lines between non-problematic, problematic, and flat out radioactive will not touch these creators. And that line moves, and I'm still trying to figure out where that line is with some creators. I will be putting in the show notes a timestamp where you can start the episode after we've had that discussion, when we're getting right into the discussion of the comics. But with some of the things that have happened the past week, it felt appropriate to bring that up now. First, to make it clear to those who don't know that we're not being opportunistic and discussing problematic creators in a week where that has come to the forefront of the industry.
I think the thing that has bothered me the most this week in watching the discourse about Ed Piskor and his death, I have seen his suicide note shared so uncritically. People just posting it, right, without any sort of thought behind what exactly it contains. And I'll say first that suicide is a devastating choice. It is an unfortunate choice, but I don't think that it's one that bears any sort of special stigma. And that just complicates our discussion about suicide. But that note was childish. That note, in just an attempt to strike back from the grave, was one of the more disturbing things I have ever read. And Piskor was a man who was loved, who was hated, who was cherished for his creations. He made mistakes, as all men do. He had positives and negatives. And I think it's fine to you know, if other creators or friends of his want to share their memories, I am not saying that they can't mourn what was to them a friend, but that has to be done in context with the way he chose to share his final thoughts with the world. And that note is a thing that I think is going to stick with us. It is going to be waved in the air as an example of when, quote, cancel culture, end quote, killed a man. And that's not what happened here. And I think there just needs to be more reflection on just, again, what it means to just go with this narrative that's starting to develop.
We do this show to entertain, to inform. I do not personally give a damn what anybody thinks about me. I do this show because it's fun, because I like talking to my friend about Batman, and because I hope that the joy and the good stories and the bitter frustration at the bad is something that informs, and hopefully we'll get some people to read some good stories that they never read before. This is a hard beginning to an episode. And if you feel like you want to just jump ahead and get into us talking about No Man's Land at a probably about 13 or 14 minutes into the episode, again, there will be a timestamp in the episode notes. Completely understand. But I hope that y'all approach this show in general, as we usually do, with that in mind. That this is a show that we do because we like talking to each other and we hope that you find good comics. But as people have said many times, comics are political. They have been from the minute that Action Comics number one happened and Superman took on a guy who was committing spousal abuse and some corrupt rich guys. And so sometimes that's what we're going to wind up discussing. I hope you enjoy the rest of this episode. I hope you come back for many more. And that's it.
Talk some comics.
Matt Lazowitz, and welcome to this week's episode of Bat Chat with Matt and Will, a Batman ranking podcast. Where each week, my co-hosts Will Nevin and I dig into three Batman stories, discuss them, and rank them on the big board, thus creating a giant list of Batman stories from best to worst. Will, what's going on tonight?
Yay! We are a week into the time change, which was a month ago if you're listening to this now. Well, if you're listening to this now, it would be weird because, I don't know how you'd be listening to this now. But I have never been so in touch with the seasons and the time change as I have as I've gotten into running. It is so much nicer running in daylight saving time. It's just so just the best. Mornings suck, right? It doesn't sunrise is until 6:30 or some shit. But I just had a nice evening in the sun with my friends. It was spectacular.
Now that I have a new job where I work from home, That morning thing is less of a pain. When I used to have to leave for work at 6:30, and it was, getting to the point where it was sunny out, and then daylight savings hit, and now it's an hour later, and I'm driving in the dark. It was the worst.
Springer.
But now I don't have to worry about it. And so, yes, I do really enjoy having that, being able to take a walk at, 6 o'clock at night and take half an hour, 45-minute walk. And it's like, oh, it's still sunny when I get home. It's lovely.
It's so nice. Twilight. So here's what's on my mind for this week. One of my law school friends and my meat space friends certainly know about this. And I've talked to my local friends about this, too. One of my very close law school friends, he was the one who was going to be most set up out of law school. Like he had this good clerkship. He got this good firm job. And then things kind of went a little sideways for him. He always was kind of an asshole and a real cocky shit too. And it had that kind of libertarian strain of cocky. And he got on Instagram with someone he thought was 15. And he said some things that he shouldn't have, and he made some plans that he shouldn't have. And so anyway, one of my closest law school friends is currently in the federal penitentiary. And I think about that a lot. I'm like, here I am living my life and doing my thing and having a podcast and having this whole barcade. I kill time in my day-to-day life just by playing some video pinball, whatever I want. And he's in the federal penitentiary. And this is a very long way of saying that I almost put a Gerard Jones book on our list, Matt.
Oh.
And then I remembered, oh, we're not going to read him for this show.
It's funny. There was going to be a discourse a little later in the episode that I think we might move up to this section.
Oh, my.
Because it's a bit germane to this.
Okay.
Because here's the thing. If you are unfamiliar out there, Gerard Jones is currently serving time in federal prison for possession of child pornography. There is a line. Chuck Dixon's an asshole. Bill Willingham's an asshole. Eddie Braganza's a scumbag. Warren Ellis is a scumbag. But there is a line you cross for me where it's like, no, I don't want anyone to go out. I don't want to be the reason anybody went out and bought a book. And even though royalties in comics really don't exist, I don't want to take the chance that somehow some money is going to get back to this guy. This is a guy who was doing jailhouse interviews with somebody a couple of years ago. And I'm like, how are you supporting someone who's in jail for this? This isn't financial crimes. This isn't, I got drunk at a bar and I got into a fist fight. This is possession of child pornography. That is the line where you cross when children are involved, that, you know, it's like, oh no, I'm done.
Yeah.
No, you're done. What got me thinking is, in my own head, here's a question. It's something to discuss, because we would have discussed it later anyway when we got to one of these books. Where is the line when someone crosses over from, I don't necessarily agree with your politics, but you have a right to have a different opinion than me, in problematic creator watch territory?
Because that is fascinating.
Yeah, because, for instance, as we said, Braganza, sexual harassment. Ellis, grooming. These are lines you cross where you are problematic. Chuck Dixon, Bill Willingham. Willingham is written for Breitbart. You write for Breitbart, you're problematic. Ethan Van Sciver, Comicsgate. You're part of a hate group. You are problematic. Dixon exists right on a line, because Dixon is not, as far as I know, espoused as a vocal member of Comicsgate. He probably agrees with most of their philosophies, but as far as I know, has not ever actually been considered part of Comicsgate. But his vocal support of Donald Trump makes him problematic in my eyes. But if someone is a Republican, but is, you know, has said, yes, I'm a Republican, but isn't loud about it, doesn't do that kind of, you know, the big bad social statements, I can't quite say you're problematic, because you're just disagree with me.
So here's where the line is for me. You can do vile things, right? You can sexually harass, you can groom, like, to the point where an entire group of women and femme presenting people coalesce and create a website about you, like Warren Ellis, like that was some heinous shit that went down. So you do bad things, or you have positions that are so vile, that are just so fundamentally incompatible with how I view the world and how I want people to be treated. And here's an example. So once again, you know, we'll dive into current events. And I don't know if this has hit national news yet. And I pray to God that it doesn't. I'm here in Huntsville, Alabama, space capital of the world. Fuck you, Houston. Fuck you, Cape Canaveral. Kiss my ass. We have space camp here, right? It's where kids can come and they can spend a week. They ride the simulators, learn all about NASA history. It's cool shit. The trolls of the world have decided to come after a transgender woman who happens to work at space camp. And it is fucking dreadful. It was first reported by a conservative outlet here in Alabama. And if you want to imagine, like, how heinous a conservative news outlet would be, like, imagine one that is based exclusively in Alabama. So they are to the right of mainstream Alabama politics. The last trans story they covered was about a local mayor who was outed as a trans woman, and then she killed herself. Sorry, content warning about that retroactively. Many apologies there. But they are just heinous fucking monsters. And so the monsters of the world have come for this poor woman who just wants to fucking work at space camp and enjoy her life. And so this has generated a conversation here in the community. And somebody was posting on Facebook about this. And he had two comments, two really wise, insightful comments. And the first was, well, if they had been with my granddaughter, I would have beat them. Well, first of all, you know, you just want an excuse to beat on queer people. You know, that doesn't make you special. Second comment he had was,
oh, I think they're okay. I just don't want them working with children.
And, let's not jump through all those hoops, right? Let's not try to make those logical arguments. Again, you just want to be a hateful bigot. It's not about protecting children. It's not about caring about them. You're insinuating that they're pedophiles, right? So you're just a hateful fucking monster. So anyway, to the point that you're on Facebook posting comments that, I'm okay with trans people so long as they're not around children. That's the part where I say that is a position that you have that is so fucked up, that is so far beyond what I would consider how decent people should react and treat other fucking breathing humans, that no, you are absolutely problematic. And that is the politest word I can use for it. What used to pass for mainstream politics, Republican politics in this country, right? Like, we could have arguments on taxation and spending. We could have arguments about defense policy. We can have arguments about foreign policy, so long as they aren't dehumanizing. But I can't have a rational, civilized debate with somebody who just says, you aren't people and you don't deserve to be treated as people. I'm trying to remember the Indiana Jones quote from Last Crusade, but, what was it? Elsa? Is that her name?
Yeah.
Yeah. She says, oh, I'm not a Nazi, right? I never believed in that. And Indy says, you stood up to be counted with them. So at the point where you stand up to be counted with the dehumanizers, you espouse those policies, we are done. D-O-N-E, period, done.
Recently, within the, I heard someone comment, not to me because I'm not in this particular situation, about how, oh, I have no problem if you're polyamorous as long as no one has children, because then you're exposing the children to this. What? That you can love more than one person? That's really?
People don't unpack. We just want to use the kids as a shield.
Yeah. But we will get to the creator who I had to do some research to determine. I mean, they were problematic flat out. But when I had to look them up and was like, okay, at what point do they cross over into this territory?
Full-blown asshole.
Yeah. But we'll get there towards the end of the episode.
An asshole dabbler as differentiated from a full-blown asshole.
Precisely. But we're not going to get there for a while because we're back with the three runs that we have been following in chronological order with the next arcs of No Man's Land, Grant Morrison's run on the Bat titles, and Injustice. We're starting with Mosaic. This is Batman Volume 1, number 565, and Detective Comics Volume 1, number 732. The writer is Greg Rucka, with pencils and inks by Frank Turan, colors by Gloria Vasquez and Wildstorm FX, letters by John Costanza, and edited by Denny O'Neill, Joseph Illich, and Darren Vincenzo. The cover date is May of 1999. Black Mask's Cult, dedicated to the, quote, true face of Gotham, unquote, is marching on buildings that survived the quake, and their next stop is the Clock Tower. The new Batgirl has been assigned to protect it, and Oracle is shocked to see this new person using her old name. So here we are, obviously from that description, back in No Man's Land. This is important in that this is Greg Rucka's first time writing a big name Bat title. He had done shorts in Batman Chronicles, the anthology of the time, but he had never written an issue of Batman, Detective, Shadow, or Legends before this. So historically, this is the first in the main line book from a creator who will become one of the defining voices of Batman for the next decade-ish. There's very little Batman in this arc. This is really about Barbara and Jim and Batgirl, and more about the environs of No Man's Land, the things that are going on, than Batman's journey in No Man's Land at this point.
And it's not a very long story. You know, these aren't jumbo issues or anything like that. It is 40 so odd pages of story. And really not a lot happens.
This is very much a character piece more than a plot piece. I mean, you're using Black Mask. You know, we're not using Scarecrow or Penguin, who we've already seen, or Two-Face or Joker or any of the real big guns here. Black Mask is, at this point, C-tier. He doesn't even make it really to B-tier until Brubaker uses him in Catwoman after No Man's Land.
To me, this story, and yes, there is a lot of the Barbara stuff going on here, and that's probably the emotional focal point in terms of the character stuff. But as far as the plot goes, reading this, I just got the sense of this is what these characters do when they're absolutely pushed to their breaking point, right? This is a city in ruins. There is no support system. You know, this is Batman relying on lockup of all people to run his, you know, his black site prison. This is Jim constantly screaming at everyone and then maybe doing a little fucking after throwing shit. Like, right, these are people who have absolutely been pushed to their limit and beyond. So some of the Barbara stuff struck me as just, I think, Rucka being very early in his career. Some of the notes just aren't quite right. But on the whole, not a bad little story.
It's interesting you say that about Rucka and Barbara, because this is released within a month or so of JLA Foreign Bodies, where you specifically said that Barbara felt off for you there as well because of how bitter she was. And that's where she is emotionally at this point. She's the one who stayed. And I also love Rucka's, the one line he has about how she's in the most defensible position in the No Man's Land, but she can't leave. She's trapped because of the wheelchair. No Man's Land is not ADA compliant.
No, it is not. I think the emotions are fine, right? It's a reasonable place for her to be in, but some of the dialogue was just strange. Like, she says literally, "There's another woman using my legs," or something very close to that. And I'm just like, that's not how I don't think anyone would talk in that situation.
I preferred it when she's, you know, using my name, using my face, seemed a little more in line, a little more appropriate to what we've know of Barbara when it comes to her dialogue.
And I think that character in that moment, you get more with less, right? Fewer words, more looks, more having the sense of kind of despair. So yeah, again, the fine detail didn't work for me in a lot of those moments. But overall, like I said, it's a very reasonable place for the character to be in.
And the same for Jim, who is breaking. We saw he was not in a great place even at the beginning after 3 months when he and Pettit had that whole thing with setting the street demons and the low boys against each other. And things haven't gotten a lot better since then. They don't go into it here, but you've also got to think, last arc, he made the deal with the devil. He made his deal with Two-Face. And that's got to be weighing on him. We get a hint of what Two-Face is up to at the very end, the last couple pages of this. But I was happy to see and remember that Jim and Sarah's conflict is played out over these 2 issues. This isn't something that drags on for 6 months of them bickering and fighting and being in a bad place with each other, because that would have gotten real tired of that real fast.
Oh yeah.
But for a couple issues over the course of what would literally have been 2 weeks at the time, I remember during the pandemic, the height of the pandemic, when we all couldn't really go out. I love Amber. I love her with all my heart. But when we were in the house together every day for like 3 months, except for when I would take a walk, can wear on you. This is pandemic level conditions for the No Man's Land. If Gordon is going to be blowing up at people, this is the person who is always right there. and also is the one person more than anyone else who's willing to call him on his bullshit, except for maybe Barbara. And I don't think Jim is overly used to being called on his bullshit.
No, because who is going to do that, right? The normal beat cops and detectives aren't going to do that because he normally makes good decisions in those situations. He doesn't have to, you know, weigh basically the lesser of three different evils.
But that's where he is. And we're still a couple of months off of his all is lost moment. This is cover date May, so it's release date March. His all is lost moment is May. Things go real bad for both Jim and Batman in May. And that's before Batman finally has to suck it up and call Nightwing and Robin back home when he realizes that he can't keep doing this the way he has. But we're still a couple of months off from that. But as you said, we can already tell Bruce himself is not making the best decisions. It's like, sure, let's put Lockup in charge of Blackgate and have him and the KGB Beast run Blackgate Penitentiary and bring anybody we capture to Blackgate where Lockup is going to watch them. That's not a decision that's going to go poorly down the line. No.
Yeah. Not a problem with that at all.
No, just because Lockup's a deranged maniac to begin with. This is a very different take on Black Mask from either before or after No Man's Land. This version of him, this sort of cult leader version of Black Mask, wouldn't have worked after No Man's Land. But it is, again, interesting to see someone pushed beyond their breaking point and what it does to them. Because Black Mask is a mobster. He's not he is a maniac, but he's not a maniac in the same way that, you know, Joker is with a gimmick or Two-Face is with his sense of order. Black Mask is just a mobster with a thing for masks. So he is in a position where it's like, oh, what good is a mobster in the No Man's Land? Penguin is the only one who's able to do that. And even Penguin is more like a feudal lord than a mobster. He's just the guy who has the one pipeline in and out of the NML. That's what keeps him on top. Black Mask doesn't have that. Black Mask doesn't have anything. So he just breaks and becomes this sort of preacher of the new face of Gotham, that everything is scarred and lawless. It doesn't hurt that his whole vendetta against Bruce Wayne plays with him wanting to bring down all these Wayne buildings. That doesn't hurt.
But he definitely doesn't get a lot of attention in this story.
No, there's a couple of scenes with Black Mask. The opening scene, then one scene where he's torturing one of Barbara's informants. And again, Black Mask loves torture. Any version of Black Mask loves torture. And then when he storms the clock tower, that's really it. And then I guess you see Bruce bring him to Blackgate. But that's all there is. He doesn't get as much play as Penguin did in Bread and Circuses or Scarecrow did in Fear of Faith. He gets probably about as much play as the Ventriloquist and Scarface did from that first arc, where they were tertiary, where it was like a whole lot of other stuff going on. And oh, by the way, Batman's just dealing with them so we can see what one of the Arkham rogues is doing. The title makes sense with mosaic, because I mean, what a mosaic is different bits of art put together to form a greater whole. And that's what this story is. It's a whole lot of little beats that are forming a fuller narrative about what's going on in the No Man's Land as it is.
And it's a good length for what it tries to do, right? This would have drug at three issues, and this was a lot to pack into one.
This is setting up a lot of story for later. That is like, okay, we're forwarding Jim's plot. We're exposing the new Batgirl to Barbara. We're establishing Lockup. It's not what would be the next month of No Man's Land, which we'll have to figure out some way to cover, which is just four sort of one shots that are like, hey, here's a couple of cute little stories of No Man's Land. One of them is Superman stops by. One is a guy who defends his house against all of the coming threats, you know, the classic, what we saw years later with Katrina, of people who refuse to leave their house no matter what, even as the floodwaters rise, sort of story. And then the month after that is the all is lost moment in 1-2 issue arc, and the introduction of the Kanes, Cassandra and David, in the other. So this is part of sort of the bridge between Act One and Act Two of No Man's Land. The art, Turan is, I don't want to say Sienkiewicz-y, because it's not that. He isn't as abstract as Sienkiewicz, but
it's close.
His art is dark, and it's a lot of hatching and a lot of just shadow and weird angles. The bodies aren't as distorted as in Sienkiewicz. His proportions don't change the same way Sienkiewicz proportions change, but it is not what we would expect from something that would get a lot of mainstream comic play.
Yeah, it is very different for a mainstream Bat title.
Which is interesting, because we had something similar in the previous arc with Disraeli, with that more cartoony style with the Penguin arc. But then coming from Alex Maleev and Dale Eaglesham, Maleev, who is a little bit in that darker vein, but was still crisper, and Eaglesham, who's a straight down the line superhero artist. So it is cool that No Man's Land not only lets other writers play with Bat characters and Bat titles, but lets different art styles play with this altered Gotham.
I want House Style. I really do. I want Kelly Jones and House Style. If you can't be Kelly Jones, then you got to be House Style. But we will, man, oh boy, we will. We'll get to some art discussion tonight.
Oh yeah, we got some stuff coming up. This is by comparison pretty tame compared to some of the other stuff that we'll be running into. This is at least consistent across the board.
Yes.
I think we've covered this.
I believe that I am satisfied. So that means it's time to put the latest chapter, No Man's Land Mosaic, on the big board.
We are up to 387 stories on the big board.
God damn, 13 to 400.
Number one is the post-crisis origin of Batman, Batman Year One.
Still coming in a sexy 69 is JLA Prometheus.
At 100 is Made of Wood, the Batman Golden Age Green Lantern team up. At 200 is Enter the Outsiders, the first two issues of Batman and the Outsiders. At 300 is Last Chance, the Batman, the animated series, complete story of Dead Man in one issue. And all the way at the bottom, at 387, War Crimes.
Nominative Determinism.
The previous arc, Bread and Circuses, is at 159. I'm trying to figure out if this is better or worse than Bread and Circuses. Bread and Circuses has more Batman, and it feels more of a complete story.
It does.
It doesn't feel like this, again, feels like it's a lot of getting pieces into place and doing a sort of vibe story rather than a straight narrative. And I mean, we all know how much we both love Greg Rucka. But again, this is one of his first Bat stories. It's not bad. It probably is above 200. It's just not as strong as a lot of the other Greg Rucka that we have on this list. Because what is it? 200 is Enter the Outsiders. Good. I don't know if it's a ton above that.
I don't know that I would put it above When in Rome at 192.
Yeah, and Fear of Faith Arc 2 is at 149, a little bit above Bread and Circuses. Arc 1 is up near the top. Yeah, I mean, When in Rome is inconsequential but gorgeous. I'd happily put it right below When in Rome, the new 193.
All right, let's do it.
Our second story of the night is Revenge of the Red Hood. This is Batman and Robin, Volume 1, Numbers 4 to 6. The writer is Grant Morrison, with pencils by Philip Tan, inks by Jonathan Glipion, colors by Pete Pentazis, letters by Pat Brousseau, and edited by Mike Martz and Janel Aslin. The cover dates are November of 2009 to January of 2010. The Red Hood and his new sidekick, Scarlet, are the new faces of crime fighting in Gotham, taking on a more lethal edge. But their attacks on the underworld have brought a new killer to Gotham, Eduardo Flamingo, a murderer who others fear. Can Batman and Robin save their nemesis and stop Flamingo? So here we are back in Morrison, two arcs down from Final Crisis, because they didn't actually write Battle for the Cowl, and it is a fairly inconsequential little story where, you know, Dick Grayson, Tim Drake, and Jason Todd all dress up in Batman costumes, and Dick logically winds up as Batman because Jason's a gun-toting lunatic and Tim is 17.
And Damian is even younger.
Yes. So here we are doing a very different Jason than what we just read in Under the Red Hood and from what we see now. I don't know. He's maybe less villainous than Winnix, but he's equally homicidal. This feels like Morrison's Nightfall. This feels like their commentary on what you get when you have a vigilante who kills in Gotham. It's also, this was cover dates of 09 into 2010. So this is late 2009. All the stuff about social media here, I mean, social media wasn't in its infancy in 09, 10, but it was still not the force that we now see it being. And this feels weirdly prescient.
Twitter was certainly a novelty in 2009, 2010.
And having Scarlet live tweet her and Jason killing mooks, again, feels weirdly prescient where we see Twitter having gone.
Tell me more about this Scarlet character.
Scarlet made her first appearance in the previous arc. Mm-hmm. She was one of the girls kidnapped by Professor Pig and made into one of his Dolatrons. She only appears in these two arcs. And she, I'd like to think, gets a happy ending and drives off and the horrible Dolatron mask falls off and she gets therapy and lives a happy life after this because we never get to see her again.
Hmm. Interesting.
Also possible that if Morrison's plans for where they were going with Batman Incorporated wound up going uncut, she might have shown up there. But who knows what the dangling plot threads that were not allowed to be picked up at that point.
It's certainly been a while since we read the first arc here.
That's the one other arc we read out of order because we read it for the Damian episode.
Mm.
So there's a lot of stuff in here that is playing directly off of events from that. We see one of the members of the El Penitente drug syndicate talking about this drug that will addict everyone. That was something Professor Pig was working on for them in the previous arc. The domino found on one of the dead mobsters. We found a similar domino on another dead criminal in the previous arc. This is why, as we've learned, reading Morrison in order really helps, because everything they do builds on everything they did before.
Morrison, as dense as always.
Yes.
I stopped to look up something. It was some line that Gordon had. Oh, the riddle of the corn dolly will have to wait until another day. I was like, oh, is that some kind of reference I missed? The first 5-6 Google hits were all annotated Morrison.
Yep. The amount of annotated Morrison is delightful when it comes to looking up this stuff. And we see a couple of times in here, but of all of the characters to become obsessed with a social media presence. Jason Todd makes a just sort of perverse degree of sense as he is the first character to be killed off because of a grassroots fan campaign.
Yeah, you have to think that's what Morrison was going for.
Oh, 100%. Twice in here, there are phone polls. The news has a phone poll about whether or not people agree with Batman and Robin or Red Hood and Scarlet. And then Jason himself using, hey, everybody, dial into this number if you want to find out Batman's secret identity. It is absolutely a reference to Jason being killed because of a phone poll.
Hilarious.
Yeah, it's a solid bit. And this arc is not Morrison's best arc of this run. But as I've said in the past, Lesser Morrison is still at least fascinating to read, to see all of the different pieces that are moving around, and to see this version of Batman's morality versus the more modern, quote-unquote, morality, which Lord knows we have seen enough of the past week since that interview that Zack Snyder gave on Joe Rogan.
Christ almighty.
Two awful tastes that taste worse together.
Between the stuff about Space Camp I was talking about earlier, and people like Rogan and RF Kennedy running for president, and oh, I'm gonna pick Aaron Rodgers as my running mate, or Jesse Ventura, we are just really, really fucked, Matt. Just really, really fucked.
I have unfollowed every Batman. I don't spend a lot of time on social media, but there are various fun little Batman fan groups that I was a member of on Facebook, all of which I have snoozed for 30 days because the minute that interview dropped, Snyder Bros were posting clips from it on every one of those sites multiple times a day.
Oh, of course they were.
And I was like, okay, I'm done. I'll come back in 30 days when the Michigas has died down. But one of the things that I think Morrison is doing here, and there's a few very specific moments of it that indicate that as much as they're pushing Jason to be edgy and extreme in all of this, Jason's not quite as far gone as he wants to make himself out to be. And I think that's a lot of this is performative for Jason.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a moment towards at the very end of part two, after he and Scarlet have captured and tied up Dick and Damien, and Scarlet says something about being worried about this or that. Jason's like, can't you just grin and quip like any other sidekick? Jason still, as much as he talks about breaking these molds, has that dynamic in his head. And when Flamingo shows up and starts attacking him and Scarlet, he jumps to her defense. There is still a hero in there underneath all of that angst.
And Flamingo, after this, or before this, or during this, who knows? Primarily a Nightwing villain, right? Is that correct?
Flamingo, he's usually a Dr. Hurt's flunky. And so he shows up the one time Dr. Hurt goes after Nightwing. He had a cameo in the Rom V stuff. Before Hurt goes to meet Batman in the desert, he sends Flamingo off to do something. That one issue of Catwoman is probably the only thing where he's really on his own. He's just, yeah, Dr. Hurt's killer. That's what we get at the end, that El Penitente is hurt. So it makes sense. And there's clues of that in there to begin with when, you know, they talk about his origin. Oh, he was forced to kill all the people he loves and it broke him, which is a similar origin to what the third Batman had.
That's a Dr. Hurt special.
Exactly. When you read that, it's like, oh, okay, well, clearly Dr. Hurt was behind this. But again, it's layered in there. You don't find out until later that it is Hurt. But reading that, it's like, ah, okay. It makes perfect sense when you see him later. Here's one thing. There's a line when Damian first sees Flamingo. His line to that is, I was expecting scary, not gay.
Not gay.
Is he using that as a slur? Or Flamingo is so flamboyantly playing on queer aesthetics. Is it derogatory or is it Damian just acknowledging the aesthetic that Flamingo is going for? Because listen, Morrison is about as far from a homophobe as you can get. So I'm inclined towards either it is an acknowledgement of the aesthetic or Morrison just being like, he's an 11-year-old and 11-year-olds say stupid shit like that.
Yeah, and I think it was much more common then.
Yeah.
We have very much evolved the language quickly when it comes to that. It was a memorable line. It was, they did that there. Okay. But it was not, did not leave a sour taste in my mouth.
No, it was a line that jumped out at me.
Now let's say if Damian had said the F slur, that would have been bad.
Yes.
And I'm sure we could, maybe not from Big 2, but we could find a comic from this era that would have gone with that.
Oh, I would lay a not insubstantial amount of money that if we read Mark Miller's work from 06 through 2012, anywhere in this same period where Morrison is writing Batman, that Miller drops that multiple times.
Not taking that bet.
Yeah. I didn't think anyone would.
Unless I'm gambling with his Netflix money, then sure, why not? Speaking of Netflix money, and yeah, we mentioned this in the column last week, but I'm real surprised that Irredeemable has apparently wound up in Netflix development hell.
Unless they've kind of realized that we have how many evil Supermen floating around on TV right now between The Boys and Invincible? Have we kind of missed the boat on the evil Superman trope at this point?
Yeah, you figured it had to be something like that because they had that big announcement of, oh, we're going to develop this in Netflix, Irredeemable and Incorruptible, and we're going to put out new comics. And then that was supposed to be last year.
I think it's, oh, we missed the boat on this one. Some of the other things in here that just to call out, because I love calling out all of the quirky stuff that Morrison does. Jason has become strangely literate, that he is both quoting Gilbert and Sullivan and John Milton, both with Let the Punishment Fit the Crime, which is a phrase, but there's a whole big musical number in the Mikado where that is the refrain. And the card that he drops about the red right hand of vengeance is a quote from Paradise Lost. So Jason is not just reading, you know, books about marketing, but is also reading the classics and apparently going to light opera.
Is this the first reference of Batman making Robin dye his hair?
The first post-crisis one. Because you remember, pre-crisis Jason Todd had red hair. That was the one thing that was different between him and Dick Grayson. And Bruce did make him dye his hair because he didn't want to let the criminals know that there was a new Robin. He wanted to maintain continuity. How they couldn't tell that Robin was suddenly a head shorter is a different issue. But this is the first time that that has come up. Because when we first see post-crisis Jason, he has black hair. That was, I think, just, again, Morrison acknowledging a little bit of continuity and poking at things a bit. But it's a great line. It's a great moment, too. And sums up a lot of Jason's issues with Dick here. And again, you get to that end, and Jason's issue with Dick seems to be as much, you haven't brought him back. Why haven't you brought him back? Jason is still just as fragile and broken as he was in Under the Hood. It's just angled in a slightly different way here because he's dealing with Dick and not Bruce.
Mm-hmm.
There it was, why didn't you kill him for taking me away from you? Now it's, why aren't you bringing him back? You could do it, but you just need to prove that you don't need him anymore. And I think underneath that is, I need him. Why isn't he back?
And it's interesting to see the relationship between Dick and Jason as compared to Bruce and Jason, because if Jason is going through a homicidal killing spree in Gotham, I would imagine Bruce takes it much more personally. Jason is like, oh, this is a problem. We should get around to it eventually.
Dick.
Probably.
Jason, when Dick gets back to the tower, Jason Todd's back. He's out there killing people. He doesn't sit there and brood over it. Like, Bruce would have been down in the Batcave for like the entire day, just staring off into the middle distance, looking at Jason's costume in the case and brooding.
Not too much brooding for Dick Bat.
No, which is good, because it makes them different characters. And I think we see here, and Dick calls it out, we see Damian for the first time actually give a crap about another human being. He feels responsible and guilty about Scarlet, who he saved from Professor Pig, now being Jason's sidekick and Flamingo possibly killing her. Damian says, I feel responsible, and Dick's responsible. That's a first. So it's the first crack we see in the attitude that Damian has demonstrated in every appearance before this. I mean, there was a little bit of it in the previous arc too, towards Grayson, but it's the first time he's cared about anyone who is not his mother, his father, or his big brother, for all intents and purposes.
Growth.
Yes. Slowly but surely. Two final things to bring up. One other character, and then a little bit of art talk. Firstly, we also meet Oberyn Sexton for the first time, the mysterious gravedigger, who is a character who will be important through the balance of this run. Do you have any idea what's going on with that guy?
No.
That's fine. I didn't either at the time. And reading this, it's like, oh, there's a clue there. There is a clue to who is under the Oberyn Sexton disguise in this story, but it is a very subtle clue and one that only makes sense after you know where it's going. But that's a great design. I love the head-to-toe black, the mask, the glasses. Oh, he was scarred by the criminal who killed his wife. Yeah, there's little hints of what's going on, but of the backstory, but nothing that is concrete yet. But it's important to not forget that character, because he will become increasingly important as we get through the Morrison bits of Batman and Robin. And finally, we have Philip Tan on art here.
Is this our problematic creator?
No. That's still coming up. No. Tan is fine. Tan is kind of a step down from Quitely or the stuff we had on Final Crisis. And I've said it when we've had other stories that have done this, not a fan of the monster penguin in continuity.
Yeah, not great.
His penguin is squat with the flipper hands and the snaggle teeth. That's like, meh. Jason's costume here is the only time that costume is used.
Good.
It's used once in Convergence. That's a callback to this story, but that's it. This is really the only time that costume pops up. I think it was supposed to come back again, and then the New 52 happened, and there it went. It's a weird choice. It's this combination of the classic Red Hood on a garishly superhero costume.
And that's also part Punisher.
And it has a cape. And, you know, unless you're Superman or Batman, I really go with Edna Mode of The Incredibles. No capes!
Yeah. The modern kind of biker look, it just works so much better.
It does. So I think I'm good on this one.
I believe, sir, that I am good. So that means it's time to a Revenge of the Red Hood on the big board.
Batman and Robin Reborn, the first arc, is up at 96. This is not that high. It is better than Mosaic. I will say I would put it above Mosaic.
The top 150 for you.
Yeah. Okay, so 150 is 150 is universe. Yeah, so 146, 147 is our little Jason Todd twofer, the post-crisis origin and White Gold and Truth, where he first meets Nightwing. I think this is better than those. I like what Morrison is playing with here. I like that this story has its tongue sort of in its cheek. And we get a lot of that in the first handful of arcs on Batman and Robin. They're all sort of big, widescreen, just superhero stories. There is all that subtle stuff that Morrison does, but really they're just adventure stories. And I get a kick out of that. I like that they're trying to do something like that here.
All right. My ceiling would be 127, player on the other side.
And you know what? I was looking right there and think, I was looking at Doomsday Book right above. I was like, yeah, this can't go above that.
Probably below Foreign Bodies at 132.
I think it's above Trinity at 137. So I think we're in a real tight little range there between 132 and 137.
I put it above 134. Batman 66 meets Wonder Woman 77.
Okay. New 134?
New 134.
Excellent. And so here we will be getting into our problematic creator watch in a moment, because when you've got this many creators, one of them's
bound to be an asshole.
Yep. Because we are about to cover Injustice Year 2, Part 2 for our final story of the night. Strap in, everybody. This is Injustice Gods Among Us, Year 2, Numbers 7 to 12, and Annual Number 1. The writer is Tom Taylor, with Marguerite Bennett co-writing the annual. Pencils by Bruno Redondo, Mike S. Miller, Tom Derenick, Zermanico, Vicente Fuentes, Daniel HDR, and David Yarden. Inks by Julian Huguenard Burt, Miller, Derenick, Zermanico, Juan Alberon, Cifuentes, Daniel HDR, and Yarden. Colors by Rex Locus and Jay Nanjin. Letters by Wes Abbott and edited by Anis Ansari and Jim Chadwick. The cover dates are September to December of 2014. The war for Earth has arrived. On one side, Superman, his Justice League, and the Sinestro Corps. On the other, Batman's Resistance and the Green Lantern Corps. The problematic creator in this case is artist Mike S. Miller, who has broken ranks with ComicsGate, but not for the right reasons, but because I don't know if he didn't think they went far enough or that they were corrupted by something. And even before that, this guy was a real piece of shit. Just look him up on Wikipedia. And
that's no good.
Just to give you a rundown of the two, he wrote, Indiegogo, which, you know, is bad to begin with, the Magnificent Seven.
Oh, no.
With such characters, heroic characters as El Rushbo and Shap Hero. But then the villain is a George Soros analog. So some nice anti-Semitism right there. He has, you know, crammed religious images into the background of his comics. If you read the story about what he did with a Mike Waringo piece of original art he had, it's like, you're just a lousy human being. Even away from being problematic, you're just not a good person. I mean, granted, by being problematic, you're not a good person, but you can be not problematic and still be a bad guy. And this guy was a bad guy to begin with, and it just got worse when it came to his politics.
And I tell you, this is not a sentence you want to read about yourself and your career. Some of his better known work is on DC's Injustice Gods Among Us.
And I will say flat out, the worst art in this book is his.
That's bad. That is so bad.
Yeah, exactly. Like the good stuff is Bruno Redondo, and the Derenick stuff is sort of right in the middle, which is Derenick is like the most reliable house style superhero artist in the world. And then the stuff that looks really awkward is Miller. But now that we've gotten that out of the way, on to the actual book here.
Well, I mean, it seems like we just have the same conversation when we're talking Injustice. Like, reading this in trade is shocking. From page to page, the quality in art can differ wildly.
It is shocking to me how just they hadn't learned. I thought it was getting better in the first half of this book, but it isn't. It's still the same problem. And I think that actually the first half of this book was a little more consistent in its art. And here it was just like, okay, no, we're going back to the old three pencilers on an issue thing. Three or more. It's not as bad as volume one was, where you'd got even more artists, but it is just also the fact that they've got Bruno Redondo doing a little bit of most issues helps, as he is a really talented artist.
And there were some just some odd artistic choices generally, right? Batman spends most of this volume on the sidelines, recovering from his broken back. We get one scene of Batman rehabbing, and he's rehabbing in the full armor. Like, that's just such a bizarre choice. Like, and I think, and that holds true for like every single character. They are always in costume. I'm sure that's been the case for this whole series, and I've never really thought about that before, but that's so bizarre.
I think there's one scene where they're not in costume, and that's in the annual. That's not even in the main series. The one scene when the various birds of prey are sitting around looking at slides of Barbara's life. Who goes, hey, we've got this one bit of downtime in the middle of this war. Let's look at one of our friends' lives in slide format.
Yeah.
And let's make sure that there aren't any pictures of all of their dead loved ones in there, because that's not going to bring the whole mood right down.
Yeah.
And the thing with Bruce also is, okay, he's in the full armor. They're preparing for the big battle. He gets teleported to the clock tower in his full costume with the cowl up. Then the next scene with a different artist, or the beginning of the next issue, he has the cowl off. Then for the rest of the book, he has the cowl on again. So he took the cowl off for like 2 seconds to let it breathe for like three panels and then pulled it back up.
You got it.
We have really reached a point with this series by the end of volume two where Superman is so irredeemably evil and dumb.
Oh, yes. Sinestro is able to play him.
He plays everyone. Like, there's scenes with him and Hal Jordan where I kind of expect him to lean in and be like, tell me, Hal, have you ever heard the tale of Darth Plagueis the Wise?
Yeah, that would not be out of place, though.
He is completely pulling a Palpatine on Hal Jordan through this entire volume. He's ingratiating himself. He's manipulating him. He's whispering in his ear about the Guardians and all this. And then it's right out of Revenge of the Sith with, you know, Mace Windu over the Chancellor. And here it's, oh, I'm like, I want Ian McDiarmid to voice Sinestro. I'm sorry, Hal. It was Guy Gardner who killed Jon Stewart. No! Exactly. And Hal buys right into it.
Like a moron.
I can't get over how Superman is dumb. Hal Jordan is dumber. Because Hal knows Sinestro. Hal has been dealing with Sinestro for years. He knows you can't trust this guy. And Taylor is not being subtle in how he's setting a lot of this up. When Guy Gardner is the voice of reason in a conversation, you know you have gone too far. When it's Superman.
Poor Guy Gardner.
Yeah. This is like Guy Gardner at his like best, most heroic of anywhere. And he winds up getting the Geoff Johns special, the arm ripped off.
After it was broken.
Yeah. There's stuff in here that, since I haven't read this before, there's things going on in this book where I'm questioning some of the moments where it's Every time I think Taylor is trying to make this the very simple story where it's like, okay, I started out making, you know, some complex moral questions. And then after a while, I was like, nah, Superman's a bad guy and Batman and his team are a good guy. And there we go. But then we get moments where it feels like he's doing a, well, Batman and his group can be just as bad as Superman when they leave the Flash with Harley for Harley to reprogram him by electrocution. It feels like that's, oh, you see, Batman and his crew aren't exactly the paragons of virtue anymore either.
Oh, and we have Gordon saying that, oh, this guy doesn't have any rights.
Yeah.
Can hold him indefinitely.
Yeah, and I'd be more okay with that if it wasn't just isolated moments. Because you get these moments and then it just pulls back and it's like, yeah, that was bad, but Superman and his group are way worse.
And Taylor also feels like he goes off into like some tangents, like Harley and Joker having a child.
Yeah, that was weird.
That very weird.
And you can sort of excuse this because this is an alternate universe, but I've seen Taylor do this in his writing in the mainstream DC Universe too. He does not have a great handle on continuity and often will just sort of be like, yeah, I'm just going to change this stuff because it makes my story better. All the stuff with Barbara the Elder being a cop. Wait, no, Barbara was never a cop. Barbara was always, you know, had a problem with Jim being a cop. And this story just made her a cop because they needed her to have disappeared.
It felt like it kind of combines Barbara and Sarah Essen.
Exactly. Especially because she's the redhead. Sarah was the redhead. And again, here, this is an alternate timeline. So sure. But a recent issue of Titans, he completely altered Starfire's backstory to suit the story he was telling, completely ignoring 40 years of Starfire continuity. It was a weird choice.
And the thing about Barbara the Elder, you could have gotten where you wanted to be and not had done it that way, right? If you want to do some kind of thing where Superman has sent in Clayface as an infiltrator. Oh, by the way, this is one of the all-time bad. He looks more like Swamp Thing. The coloring is all weird. It's no good. No bueno. I think you could have gotten there and told that story without it being Jim's missing wife, presumed dead, and Clayface is here to tell you exactly where he apparently killed her.
Yeah, the annual, that, and then the first of the Sinestro slowly manipulating Hal Jordan beats. Because there's three in here. There's this one where Hal and Sinestro go off on this mission and wind up buddying up, and then Sinestro killing Despero in front of Hal and making it look like he had no choice. And then the final one with Guy Gardner, these are his Emperor Palpatine moments. And that's how I noted them in my notes, because they absolutely read like Tom Taylor just saw Revenge of the Sith again and was like, yeah, Sinestro and Sidious, there's something similar there. Let me run with that.
The middle one was especially, for lack of a better word, corny. What was the guy's name?
Despero,
right? He just, is he falling from the sky? He
can travel through the void, and the Sinestro Corps basically found him and just chucked him at Earth.
Yeah. And so Sinestro flies and is like, oh, I am going to save the day. You will not harm Earth. And Despero's like, what the hell are you talking about? What's going on here? Sinestro's clearly following a script. And I suppose he's a good actor. Because everybody buys it.
It's the scene from the beginning of Revenge of the Sith, where Palpatine is there, tied to grappled to the chair, and Count Dooku is there. And like the whole deal is like, yes, I'm going to kidnap you. And then the Jedi will take me in and I'll be able to live out the rest of the war as we do our plan. And Palpatine instead is like, no, Anakin, kill him. And again, it's Christopher Lee, so he is a good actor. But the beautiful look in his face when he's like, he realizes, oh shit, I just got screwed by this guy. Damn it. Despero does not get that moment. He just gets his head, he just gets his neck snapped. And speaking of weird art choices, there's a scene in issue 9 where Catwoman, in disguise as one of the super Gestapo, takes out the Flash. And then the Flash kind of collapses. And they do that Pieta pose that is another one of these things where if I never see another comic artist riff on the Pieta, it will be too soon. But of all the times to use that, why Catwoman and the Flash? There's no connection between the two characters. It just sort of, I guess, struck the artist as, hey, I'm going to do the Pieta right here. That's supposed to be an intimate relationship. And here it's two characters that don't know each other. Every time I think this series can't get more brutal, it finds a way.
Oh, always does.
Whether it's Mogo, and I freaking love Mogo, the Green Lantern that is a planet, just wiping out a quarter of the Sinestro Corps, Jim Gordon ripping off half of Cyborg's face, Superman.
I don't know how to work computers, but I know how to turn shit off.
Yes. Superman heat visioning through Black Canary. And then super again, Hal Jordan, as I said, doing the Geoff Johns special on Guy Gardner. And then the again, the destruction of Mogo. It is a truly brutal comic.
Well, you know, if you do have a planet you want to get rid of, pushing it into a sun is a pretty good way to do it.
Again, to continue my Star Wars analogies, it's better than blowing up what is something the size of a moon orbiting another planet that would logically just rain rubble down on that small forest moon and wipe out everything on it.
Yeah.
The very end, the epilogue, I like it because it gives Black Canary a happy ending, but something that sugary sweet feels out of place in this book.
I want to say they come back. They have to come back.
I'm sure they do.
Yeah.
Your big emotional moments in your Injustice books feel like they either need to be the, you know, Superman giving into his rage moments that we get, or one that did pretty much get me, Jim saying goodbye to Barbara.
Oh my God. Yes. So I've read most of these. I don't know if I finished this full series, but moments I remember, right? Of course, you remember Superman, we initially Breaking Bad, punching Joker through the chest, which is apparently from our friend Mike Miller. He did that, apparently. I remember, and I guess this was in the last volume, because it wasn't in this one, Renee smacking Superman with the Washington Monument.
Next volume.
Oh, it is? Really?
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet.
Oh, okay. Because he's not in the Sinestro suit. Maybe Superman being in the Sinestro Corps. If you don't know again how far Superman has fallen, he joins the Corps in this book. But yeah, Gordon getting a hero's death and saying to Batman, yeah, I know it's been you, Bruce. I know it's been you all along. You know, take care of Gotham. And I'm signing off. You can't kill off Jim Gordon in Batman, but you can kill off Gordon in Injustice. And if you're going to kill him off, like, make that death mean something. And there's a whole lot of dumb comic book science that gets us to this point. Like, oh, he's got cancer, but the superhero powers are making the cancer get worse. And he dies at the precise moment in the story when it would serve the story the best. But he has that moment. So many goofy things going on around it, but that moment, absolutely perfect.
Tom, for whatever else he does right or does wrong, knows how to get you in the gut when he has a moment like that.
Oh, he sure does.
This death, Oliver's death at the end of volume 1. By the way, I looked it up. The Montoya thing is in volume 4.
Really?
Or year 4, volume 1. Yeah, because I've seen that panel meme, so I know it happens. But that's in year 4, volume 1. That's down the line.
They still working them super pills.
Because I was curious. I went like, okay, we've got plenty more of all the rest of these. How long does this thing go? Oh, there is 5 volumes of this, 5 years of this, 2 years of Injustice 2, a year zero, another miniseries, which is told from Harley's perspective, and the Injustice versus Masters of the Universe miniseries, which I actually am really kind of curious to read Injustice versus Masters of the Universe, just to see He-Man throw down with evil Superman. That just sounds fun.
Yeah.
I'm curious to keep reading, mostly because I'm kind of, it's like, how do things get worse? Like, Superman just blew up Mogo and Ganthet and has a Yellow Lantern ring. How can things get worse before you get to the game? And can you imagine what it's like to have to keep writing all this and never actually be able to write, like, the canonical version of the game? That never happens. There isn't an adaptation. Right,
the game has any number of different endings.
True, but you got to think one of them has to be canonical, at least because there's a sequel. So logically, one of them has to lead into whatever the plot of the sequel is. But one way or the other, at the end of this volume, it's like, okay, well, the Resistance might not have fallen, but Superman is super evil. And I mean, at least at the end, Hal is kind of like, you know, looks at the destruction and it's like, well, what have we done? It's like, okay, maybe he's not completely gone. Maybe I do sense some good within him to finally hit the last Star Wars beat that I can with this. And this is, I think, the first time we've had more Star Wars talk than Star Trek talk on this podcast.
I know. I have to think of something to balance it out, but I got nothing.
Taylor's first gig in American comics was Star Wars. He wrote Star Wars books for Dark Horse.
Huh.
But yeah, I think unless there's anything else in here that we haven't touched on.
No. So, well, I'd say overall, it's got a good sense of scope, right? We certainly feel the consequences, and you know, they talk constantly about, oh, the war is coming. And then when it gets there, like, it's something to see play out. But yeah, man, the art is still just the pits on this.
It is. And I feel like, I mean, the war is, well, this is, I said, 7 issues, counting the annual. And the war is 4 of the 7. The last 4 issues of this are mostly a big battle scene with a couple of pullbacks to quieter moments, but not a lot of them. Oh, we also do get the No Duh Award of the night to, oh, Lex Luthor is the one who's betraying Superman and his Justice League.
Shock.
How could anyone have expected Luthor to be the one selling everyone out? Shocking.
Oh, that means it's time to put the back half of Injustice Year 2 on the big board.
The first half of this is actually the highest of the Injustices, probably because it had the most consistent art and had some great Gordon moments. But the art is back to being wildly inconsistent here. So
we also get the best Gordon moment.
We do get a great Gordon moment in here. But also minimal Batman in general.
Very true.
Because that's at 174. This is not going above that. The current Injustice stuff is at 174, 214, and 223.
It's a really good Gordon moment, though.
It is.
All right. I won't insist upon this being higher than Volume 1, but it's still top 200.
I think it does beat the other two, because again, the art on the others drags that down so low. Because as bad as the art is here, it is worse in Volume 1.
Very, very true.
So aside from that, as the ceiling being Volume 1, do you have a floor? Other than, again, you wanted it to be top 200, so
I'd probably say Mosaic at 194.
Okay.
So what we just put up there. And I'd say I probably wouldn't put it above 89 at 178.
Well, okay, here's something. Another book that is wildly all over the place. Batman Volume 3, Annual Number 1 at 188. The one that has that really good Tom King, David Finch Ace story and the really good Scott Snyder, Ray Fawkes, Declan Shalvey, Quiet Night in Gotham, and then the Law of Diminishing Returns on each of the short stories in there.
Probably above that.
That Gordon moment earns this a lot of grace,
mm-hmm.
but it's not as fun as I Was the Love Slave of a Plant-Based Killer at 182.
Very true.
So how does 186 sound to you? Okay, I'm good on that.
Under Scottish Connection, above 66 meets Steed and Mrs. Peel.
Yes, indeed. I'm curious to see where we go as this continues, because so this was the Lanterns. I think Volume 3 is Magic, Volume 4 is the Gods, and then I don't know what goes on in Year 5. But I've got Volume 3 waiting and ready to go. So we'll get there, and probably sooner than the gap in between the last ones of these, because we didn't need to squeeze Final Crisis in between the other Morrison stuff. Because trying to do Final Crisis the same week as we did a volume of Injustice and a volume of No Man's Land would have been asking too much of our poor beleaguered minds.
So hard.
But that's it for this week. Next week, we're celebrating the 75th birthday of one of my favorite writers in comics with three stories by John Ostrander. We'd like to thank our Patreon backers, Dan Grote, Josh Wheel, Mrs. Abigail Hartbaum, Asimov Fangirl, Tony Thornley,
Go Utes,
Sam Hopper, John Wickham, Robert Secundus,
Bobby Two Bucks,
Tim Rooney, Georgios Regioli, David Wheel, Alexander Wheel, Matt McThorne,
McThorny,
Dan Offer,
Barely Newer,
and Nate Rendell for their support. You can follow this podcast on Twitter at Batchat Comics, and the show is available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music /Audible, and on comicsxf.com, where new episodes drop every Thursday. You can support the podcast on Patreon at patreon.com/batchat with Matt and Will, where you can get shout-outs, bonus content, pick a story, and even come on the show. If you want to hear more of my ramblings, mostly about the three C's, comics, cinema, and cats, you can follow me on Twitter and Blue Sky at MattLaz1013.
And I'm at Will Nevin on Twitter only, because I'm never leaving that place, but I'm leaving this show. Good night, Huntsville!
And be sure to visit ComicsXF at ComicsXF.com, at ComicsXF on Blue Sky, for our weekly Friday Bat Chat roundup of new Bat books, for my other show, WMQ&A, where my longtime best friend, Dan Grote, and I interview comics creators, retailers, publishers, journalists, and other related tradespeople, as well as all the other stuff Will and I are writing. And stay safe out there, folks. Gotham is not a place to be after dark.